Hi friends, it's Brittany. Before we dive into today's episode, I have a quick ask for you. I need your help. I'm doing a short listener survey to get to know you a little bit better. Who's tuning in? What do you love? And how I can keep Conscious Pathways fresh, meaningful, and aligned with what you need. It won't take more than 5 minutes, and your feedback means so much to me. It helps me grow and helps this podcast to grow with you. You'll find the link in the show notes, and I would be so grateful if you took a moment to share your thoughts. Thanks for being here. Thanks for listening. And now let's get into the episode.
And I feel like we live in a world where a lot of people never come alive. And if what we consider education, that especially that, you know, that birth through, you know, 18 years old time frame as a chance for children to learn what it means to be up, feel like you're alive, and just for, even for a day, even for a week, but maybe they find the thing that brings them alive for a lifetime. But what they'll learn is the habit of pursuing, finding a purpose in life.
Welcome to Conscious Pathways, the podcast where we explore the intersection of education and social justice through transformative conversations. I'm your host, Brittany, and I am so ecstatic that you are joining me on yet another episode. I want to give a special shout out and thank you to my Patreon subscribers who do get access to this episode a little bit early. They also get access to Ask an Expert, which is a section where you can ask me or one of my expert guests any specific questions and we can answer them live on the podcast. And just other great goodies for just $5 a month, which is a little bit cheaper than a cup of coffee here in San Diego. Today I am joined by just someone who's been such an inspiration to me for years since my, you know, just started my teaching journey, Teacher Tom. Teacher Tom is an early childhood educator, international speaker, education consultant, teacher of teachers, parent educator, and author. He is best known, however, for his namesake blog, Teacher Tom's Blog, where he posts daily since 2009. Chronicling his life and times of his little preschool in the rain-soaked Pacific Northwest corner of the USA. For nearly two decades, Teacher Tom was the sole employee of the Woodland Park Cooperative School, a parent-owned and operated, knit together by Teacher Tom's democratic, progressively play-based pedagogy. Teacher Tom came into teaching through the back door, so to speak, having enrolled his own child into the cooperative preschool, where he began working daily with his daughter's classroom as an assistant teacher. Today, Teacher Tom shares his play-based pedagogy with online courses through early childhood educators, produces online early child conferences, consults with organizations about his family school program, and inspires early years audiences around the world. And that's really exactly what he does. He's been such an inspiration, I know, for me when I was a baby educator, just my first couple of years, and just looking for ways to learn more, look at who was doing things out there, different pedagogies. Teacher Tom's blog was one that I consistently went through and really went to for knowledge. And there were things that I would take from his blogs that I would implement in my classrooms, and I would see progress, and I would just see how things would change. So it was always really big inspiration. So it's been such an honor to have Teacher Tom join me on this podcast this week and share his knowledge. This is clearly something that he is very passionate about and loves, just like we all are and are passionate about early childhood education. So let's hop into that interview. Hello and welcome to Conscious Pathways. I am joined by the wonderful Teacher Tom. Thank you so much for joining me.
I'm happy to be here, Brittany. Thanks for inviting me.
I am so excited to have you here. I started following your blog early on in my teaching career because I was just online trying to figure out, you know, this early childhood teaching, preschool teaching, trying to find like, okay, who else is out here doing this thing? Who's, you know, what's going on in the world? What should I be doing? And I think I found one of your blogs and I was just like, wow, this is great.
Well, thank you.
So it's such an honor to have you on. And I like that the blog is still on Blogspot. It just brings me back.
It's not only on Blogspot, but I'm using like the most basic template you can possibly use.
I love it. Every time I go on and it's like, oh, it has not changed. I love it. It brings me the utmost joy.
Old fashioned.
Yes. But tell me a little bit about how you got your start in education.
Okay. I, it was not part of my plans in life So, you know, we talk about, you know, it's a cliche to say life is a journey, but it is. And, you know, I spent the first, you know, three and a half decades of my life, you know, trying to be a writer, trying to be, you know, being a little bit junior business executive. You know, I was a baseball coach. I did all kinds of things like that. And, but it was when our daughter was born in 1996. I was lucky. My wife was able to support the family with one income. And so I got to be a stay-at-home parent, and which is, you know, for a man, it's a really big deal, right? Mm. It's just like,
yeah.
I remember my father saying to me that he thought I was the luckiest man alive. And as a boy, when your father says that to you, you know, you might be doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. And so that felt really good. And anyway, I really was into the stay-at-home parent aspect. Mm-hmm. I love the idea of staying at home, being basically an introvert. I just had these yep. visions that I would spend my days, you know, cuddling and making snacks and teaching her how to, mm-hmm. you know, to cook with me or to, you know, and all these kind of things. And that was my idea. But probably before she was even 2 years old, she would start getting up in the morning and saying, "Papa, this morning, let's do something. Let's go somewhere." And so, I didn't know what that meant. And so I would, we'd go to parks, we'd go to the local playgrounds, and, you know, there'd be some other kids there once in a while. And one day I was chatting with one of the parents there, and she said that her kid was enrolled in a preschool called a cooperative preschool. And the cooperative preschool, for those listeners who don't know, is really one where the parents get to go to school with their kids. And, you know, that had been one of my issues, is whenever I'd brought up the idea of preschool with my wife, she would say, "But her daughter's one of the lucky ones. She doesn't need to go be dropped off at preschool." My mother-in-law said the same thing. My mother said the same thing. So, you know, you don't go against those women, right? Those are the powerful women in your life, and you listen mm-hmm. to them. And so, you know, so when I found out about this, I said, "Can I go? Can we go?" And they were all like, "Yes. If you go with her, you can." And so that began my journey of seeing what early childhood education could look like. I got very lucky as mm-hmm. the teacher of the class, Chris David, who is to this day I consider my most important mentor, was a master play-based educator. She really understood it. She was well-versed. She was experienced. And, you know, I still wasn't thinking about becoming an educator myself, but after 3 years in her classroom, as our daughter was preparing to move on to kindergarten, she said to me, one day she just pulled me aside. She said, "What are you going to do when your daughter's in school all day?" Mm-hmm. And I started thinking, do I want to go back to sitting at a computer writing? It seems so lonely, so hollow. Mm-hmm. My daughter had taught me about the importance of connecting in life, finding that place, even as an introvert, where you can go and get mm-hmm. some energy. So you can go get some ideas and being with young children, I realized I was with the geniuses, right? The smartest people in the world. And she said to me, she said, "Well, have you thought about becoming a preschool teacher?" And it was flattering. And it took me about 48 hours to suddenly realize that's what I want to be. And so, you know, so then I, you know, did some coursework. And that even before I'd finished my degree, I'd already been hired by the Woodland Park Cooperative Preschool. And, you know, in our profession in early years, there's a dearth of teachers. There even was then back in the 90s, and it's even worse now. So I've done a lot of continuing education, but that's what got me into it, right? That's what got me going. Mm-hmm. And I just, you know, I just went in those classrooms and I just imitated my mentor. People would walk in my class and say, "This could be teacher Chris's class." I'd sing the same songs. I would use the same phrases. Yeah. And there's nothing wrong, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. So that's the beginning of the journey. And now over time, you know, I've kind of developed my own things, but it's all grounded in that early mm-hmm. experience.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that you had such a great mentor. And I think that that's one of the greatest ways that we learn. I remember going through my teacher preparation programs and we learned a lot about theory, and I love theory. I'm a mm-hmm. big theory proponent. Like, I'm constantly wanting to learn more about theory. And when I teach about child development, I'm like, okay, let's understand the theory of why children are the way they are. Yeah. Let's understand how their brains work. Let's understand developmentally where they are. Theory, absolutely important. Yes. But I think a lot of my knowledge came from just being in the classroom doing the thing. So observing mm-hmm. how other teachers did this, how they talked to students, observing, you know, and just really finding mentors that aligned with my own kind of personal, you know, pedagogy and education, that really skyrocketed my journey as a teacher. Cause I had teachers that I worked with where I was like, I'm not sure if I'm necessarily vibing with this way that we're working with children. And not really having the vocabulary to understand like why it wasn't in alignment with my own values. But then, you know, working with other teachers, working with more play-based, you know, Reggio schools, I was like, oh, okay, I get it now.
Yeah, well, you need both, right? You need to have the good examples and the sort of more, I'm not going to say bad examples, just the people who are on a different part of the journey is how I'm going to view it. Because, you know, because being in a cooperative, you're there with, you know, 20 parents, right, as well as the teacher. And you're seeing lots of different styles and approaches. And many of them, many parents are just natural pedagogues, right? They're just really good at it. They just come in and you go, oh, my God, that's who I want to be when I grow up. And then others, you hear them, you know, shout at a kid or do something or be bossy or commanding or dictatorial in some ways. And you're going, you know, I don't want to end up being that guy.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. It's important to see both of those. And then, you know, I'm always talking about, you know, with teachers who are coming into the field, just make a list of what your values are, make a list of what's important to you. And when you have that list, that's going to be your guiding star, right? That's going to be the thing that keeps you on that track of like, am I doing things that are in my values? And if I'm not, then like, why not?
Yeah.
Let me ask some strategic questions.
Well, it's interesting too, because I find that one of the things that has become increasingly important to me, and I realize I was doing it back then without consciously doing that, is when you come across somebody who's doing something differently than you or might not immediately vibe, start asking questions. Asking them questions and really observing what they're doing, because they have a reason for it and their perspective might teach you something because that's all we have, right? All we have is our own perspective, really. And my, I have this, you know, I really like our conversations about white male privilege because I've got it all, right? I'm a middle-aged, middle-class, white American male. So I've got all those privileges. And so when I make the assumption that I'm the smartest guy in the room, that's just, that's because society has been telling me that. And I, when I was a boy, I remember thinking that all the time. Oh, well, I'm just so smart. I'm good at math. I'm good at music. I'm good at all this stuff. But that's because those are the, now I understand that that was not the perspective of 99% of my classmates. I really found myself, I constantly am looking for, that's why I read a lot. We were talking before we went on the air about we love to read. Is that every time you read something, you're getting a whole world. You're getting a completely whole world perspective change. You don't have to agree with it. You just have to see that it's there and why it's there.
You touched on something so important. That is perspectives and how that does shape, you know, our behavior, that shapes the language that we use, that shapes the relationships that we find, right? And how we find relationships and how we forge relationships, right? And that a lot of that comes from our own perspective and our own background and, you know, kind of that lens that we see the world in. And, you know, especially when we're working with, you know, parents within early childhood education, we're working with, you know, other teachers who have different perspectives, but we're also working with other families and parents that have other perspectives and different cultures and different backgrounds. And, you know, it's something I'm always saying in my trainings that we need to just be curious. We need to just ask some questions, right? Because they might just have a whole other perspective that you might not even be thinking about. That's not even your lens, like if you're thinking about a camera, that's not even in your like your realm of view. You can't even view it, right? And so you don't always have to agree with their perspective. You don't always have to agree with, you know, why they're making certain decisions or why they do certain things. But it's important that we're curious and we ask questions and we genuinely just try to find out like, okay, where are you coming from on this? So that I can understand a little bit and I can maybe either shift my perspective or just understand. And it's a powerful thing to do.
or include the other perspective. I think that's the part that really excites me the most is I was talking to an Ojibwe educator named Hopi Martin a few years back. And he said to me, he goes, the way our people look at it is that, you know, imagine you're sitting at a campfire. And you're looking at the fire. And I ask you about that fire. And you tell me about the color, the heat, the size, the smell, all the stuff you can perceive of that fire. Because, but then I've got to ask the person sitting next to you. Because they're going to see it from a little bit different perspective. And I've got to go all the way around that fire And I got to hear each one of the perspectives as I go around the fire before I really understand that fire. And then after I've done that, what we look at it is that you got to then ask the birds in the trees. You got to ask the worms underground. You got to ask the trees themselves. So you'll never have the full perspective. You'll never have all the perspectives.
Yes.
But if you're just in the process, to me, the way that metaphor works for me is I just think I get smarter every time I get to hear what somebody else, their perspective. Yes. I get bigger. The world gets bigger for me. And sometimes, gosh, you know, this is true. Sometimes somebody will say something you go like, well, that's BS. And then a few years later, something will come up and you go, oh, now I know what they were talking about. Now I know. Yeah. So it's always like, never just shut it down.
Yeah. Yeah. That reminds me of this concept that I'll sometimes train about as well, is like that cultural humility, right? Yeah. And that ability to understand that I will never be proficient in someone else's culture, right? And so, be as a Black woman, I can't even say that I'm fully proficient in, this culture, because my experience as, a Black woman who is from Southern California and has been here a good majority of my life is going to be different than a Black woman's experience coming from Alabama, right?
Absolutely.
Our cultures are going to be different. Our language is going to be slightly different. And so I can't just go there and say that, oh yeah, I know everything about what it is to be, a Black woman from the South, because I don't, right?
Right.
I can't say that I know everything about everyone's experience, who comes from Mexico, just because I live next to the border. Like, I can't, and I don't.
But like you
but
say,
what I can do is I can be really curious.
Curious. I mean, to me, that's everything. That's what play-based learning is all about. It's taking advantage of that natural curiosity we have. And I was just talking to Denisha Jones not long ago, the Dr. Denisha Jones.
Love her.
Yeah, she's wonderful. And, and she was just talking, she was just saying, school just seems to kill curiosity. It seems to kill curiosity in children. Yeah. And, we have these, we work with the youngest ones, right? And they ask questions about everything. Mm-hmm. Like, why do we have toes? Why is up? They ask these mm-hmm. really profound questions. And when we listen with curiosity, mm-hmm. we see how profound those questions are. As adults, so often, I think what we do is we sort of dismiss them like, well, I can't go into the whole conversation about evolution, about toes and all that kind of stuff, or up is up because perspective and all this stuff. But the truth is, it's just being with mm-hmm. that question and that sense of wonder about the world. I think that's the piece that we also get so wrapped up in getting answers. And I love that we don't know really how the brain works. And people always are talking mm-hmm. about, they call it neuroscience. They know what's sparking off, and they know that something's going on here and there, and there's neurons and there's synapses and all this kind of stuff going on, and there's mm-hmm. regions of the brain and this part's. We don't know how the mind is constructed. We have no idea. Yeah. Everything's a guess. And I love mm-hmm. that. I absolutely think that's powerful to just sit with the wonder. Again, before we went on the air, we were talking about taking a little break from media, taking a little break from social mm-hmm. media and stuff like that, and how powerful that can be. That's the problem with having the computer in your pocket, right? This little computer in your pocket all the time, is that if somebody says to you, did Hank Aaron hit the most home runs? Well, there's no question about it now. You can't have a discussion about it because somebody's going to look that up. Yeah. And the answers are right at our fingertips, and I love answers. But more important mm-hmm. to me are the questions and being able to formulate really powerful questions.
That's reminding me of something that I've been recently doing in classrooms more often now is, I'll be just like sitting with children and kind of observing them play and, just being around them. And I'll just start posing random questions. Like, I wonder why, the trees are growing like this. I wonder what bees eat, just throwing out random little questions.
And I love the way you phrased that too, because it wasn't really a question. You were just reflecting. It was one, I wonder. Right? You were expressing your sense of wonder about the world, which is a great role modeling thing to do. Mm-hmm. I tell people that all the time is that when we ask a question is a little bit like commanding. We're insisting on an answer, usually, mm-hmm. right? When you say, what color is
usually.
This? Right? I mean, there are open-ended questions, mm-hmm. but I wonder is such a beautiful way to interact with young children because it's like a loose part. They can take it or leave it.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Oftentimes they just kind of leave it. Every once in a while, I'll ask a question. I'm like, well, that's because of this. And someone will say, no, actually, you know, it sparks a lively debate.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and it could be, you know, things, serious things. It could be silly things. Right. And, you know, just kind of throwing it out there. Like you said, they'll take it or leave it. You know, if they're interested in it, then, you know, who knows, it might spark a whole, you know, project, and it might spark a whole, you know, investigation into something that, you know, they hadn't really thought about before. I think sometimes, you know, I love the idea of, you know, project-based learning. And, you know, a lot of my background is in Reggio school. So really, you know, child-driven, child-directed, and, you know, play-based, all those really beautiful things. But I think, you know, when we're first getting into these topics, we can take it very literally. And we're like, well, I have to give them a project. Then we have to do this for this amount of time. And then I have to move on to the next project next month. And it's like, not really. That's not the heart and soul of the thing. Really, it's a lot of, you know, we were kind of talking about this before, too, and how, you know, with dog training and how, you know, just kind of, it makes you approach things in different ways. And so I always think about something that Cesar Millan always says, like, he's like, I'm not training the dog, I'm training the people.
Yes, absolutely.
And it's so true. It's like, okay, I have to train the adults in the room to kind of, you know, let go of our preconceived notions about how things have to be, and to really just approach it with that same sense of curiosity, approach it with that same sense of wonder, and allow the child to kind of take that in whatever direction they're kind of thinking of. But you'll be amazed at the directions that kids take these projects and these ideas when they are fully free to think and create and ask questions and try things out and fail and try again. Their learning, it's a beautiful sight to see. Like, you're just watching it in real time. And it's so much less work as you on the educator, because when in the beginning, I remember in the beginning, I was just like, I have to do all these things, and I have to do this. I have to train out the toy. I have to switch out the toys every so often. I have to go do this. I have to plan this. I have to cut this out. And it's like, I was like running myself ragged in those first couple of years, just like doing the most when I didn't have to. You don't have to do all of that.
Well, and it frees you up to be, I think, what we should be as researchers. We should be observers. We should be people there. You know, you can still do an assessment. You just don't have to interrupt the kid for it. You're sitting there saying, oh, I see that kid's now able to climb, you know, three steps up that ladder or whatever it is, and just take note of what's going on and be present. And when you're a researcher, then you're the learner, right? That makes puts you in the position of being curious. And if everybody's curious, it's in a learning environment. And you mentioned project-based. To me, project-based is, it's very clear from, you know, I've spent a lot of the last decade reading everything I can about the way humans learn, the way, you know, what's the science on this? What are those? I mean, it's amazing how little of that actually finds its way into traditional schools, the actual science of how people learn. And project-based learning is the best way to learn. I mean, it really is. And it usually involves not just sitting someplace, getting a list of things that you need to remember or write answers. Usually what it's all about is people coming together and asking a group question like, how do we do this? Right? What do we do now? And sometimes it's a simple thing. It's you know, when the kids are on the playground and they're you know, they're digging trenches and they're digging trenches. We always had this cast iron water pump at the top of the sloped sand pit, and which is wonderful because, you know, they all know that once the water starts flowing, it's going to go downhill. And to listen to them say, we want the water to go over here. What now? Let's dig a deep hole here and let's make it stop here. And they were doing this. They were doing what everybody would call STEM learning, right? They were doing pure engineering. They were doing technology. They were doing mathematic calculations and all of this. And then they got to test it with their full bodies by pumping that water and running down the hill, following it. And then if it wouldn't do what they wanted, then they'd figure out, they'd start digging real fast to make it go where they wanted it to go. And everybody's in on this, right? It's a project that they've got together. And I can see a lot of people might say, but how, that can't be useful. But it's infinitely useful because now they know the physics is in their bodies. It might not, they might not know the words of the physics. They might not be, you know, but when they get to high school or college and the physics, the textbook comes up with those, they will intuitively, they'll know it now. Not intuitively is the wrong word. They'll know it in their bodies. Their bodies will already know this information. And then their brains can go, aha, that's what my body's been trying to tell me. Now I've got words for it.
Yeah. Exactly. It is infinitely useful. There's so many really beautiful things that happen when we just kind of take a little bit of the overstructuredness out of education and allow children to be curious and to ask questions and to try trial mm-hmm. and error, right? And the beautiful things that when we do that, you see that they start working together yeah. more, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I've been in classrooms where it's like pulling teeth to get the kids to work together, you know, because they're all trying to do their own thing. And it's like, well, we haven't created an environment where this is natural to them. Right. Like it makes sense, right? We've created this environment where, you know, they're constantly going to the adult to solve their problems.
Yeah.
So they don't have to go to each other to help to yeah. problem solve together because the grown-up will always do that.
Right.
And again, it's just so much additional work as you, the teacher, or you, the adult in the room, because you're, you know, now you're suddenly wearing every hat in the room. You're like, okay, well, I got to solve all the problems and then I have to do this and I have to feed everyone. And it's just like, teaching is hard enough as it is. Yeah. You don't need to make it even harder on yourself.
Well, and I encourage teachers to do this all the time. Is when mm-hmm. when there's some project that needs to get done around the school, you know, or mm-hmm. our child asks you to do something, their first thought should be, can another child do this? Can the children do this themselves? Mm-hmm. For example, yeah. you know, there's always in a preschool. I don't teach children how to read at preschool. I don't think it's developmentally appropriate. We do lots of things that are mm-hmm. that are literacy, you know, that support literacy, like dramatic yes. play and mm-hmm. and we read to yes. the children and all of those kinds of things. And yes. there's plenty of books around. And there's always a few that have taught themselves mm-hmm. how to read. And so yeah. if a child comes to me and says, "Teacher Tom, what does this say?" My answer is almost always, "Well, Wyatt can read." And let them yep. go, "Oh, I'll go to Wyatt." Or if somebody says, "Teacher Tom, yeah. we want to tie this rope onto here." And I'll say, "Well, you know, Sally can tie." And then suddenly, then almost always the response is, "Yeah, you're right." And they run off to Sally and get her to tie the knot for them. And I think that's mm-hmm. that's what makes, well, my favorite example is that, you know, as a preschool teacher, we go through art supplies, right? And I would order mm-hmm. these boxes of art supplies and they would all show up on one day, you know, FedEx would show up and pile all the boxes, usually in some inconvenient place. And yep. always for years, I would shove them off into a corner and I'd tell myself every mm-hmm. day, right? We're busy. We already talked about how busy we are. We got so much to do. I'd say, well, yep. you know, tomorrow I'll do this, or I'll come in early the next day and put it away. And sometimes mm-hmm. those boxes would sit there, you know, for weeks, if not months. And, you know, with holes torn in the sides because I'd reach in to just grab something out to use in the classroom. They never made it to the storage room. Yeah. And then one day, the guy, the delivery man, put them in the middle of the classroom. He didn't put them in the hallway or at our interway place. He put them right where we were. And so we got in there. And the kids are like looking at these boxes. And I said, "Teacher Tom, what is this?" And I said, they look like boxes. I knew what they were, but I just made statements of fact. They look like boxes. And they said, "What's in yeah. them?" And I said, "The only way to find out is to open them." So here we did. Then we spent like 2 hours because the boxes are really taped shut. Yeah. They're hard to get open. And we didn't mm-hmm. have, and the children had no tools for this. So they had to be innovative. I didn't give them knives or scissors or anything. Yeah. And so they're sitting there wrestling with these boxes, working together, strategizing, coming up with ways. And then finally mm-hmm. there was one box that I knew it either had jugs of tempera paint or jugs of white glue in it. And they're struggling with this. Mm-hmm. And finally they pull one out and they go, "It's paint." And they all start celebrating that it's paint. And then they go and put it over on a bench on the side of the room and they get out the next box. And then they, as they go through the boxes, not only are they unpacking them, but they're starting to organize the materials along this bench so that they're all sorted the way they thought it should be sorted. And it was pretty much right. The paper was all in one place. The brushes were all in one place. And then some of the kids would be coming over and saying, "Let's use that tomorrow. I'd like to play with that tomorrow. Let's do the," and they started planning the curriculum. Right? Because they saw what yeah. was available. They're going, "Okay, let's do that. Oh, the foam paints. Let's do foam painting." You know, and it was, and from then on, that was just when the supplies arrived, it was up to the kids. And I would let them decide yeah. where to put it, how to put it away, how to unpack it. And for me, that's, mm-hmm. it's a useful project. It's a meaningful, yeah. personally meaningful project. And look mm-hmm. what they're doing. They're planning their own future.
Yeah.
Self-motivated, working together. I mean, isn't that what we want out of the world? Isn't that what citizens should be? People who are yes. self-motivated and a good teammate?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm always saying, like, it's important that we're being intentional when we're in the classroom. So what is it, you know, if I'm bringing something into the classroom, like, what is my intention? What am I hoping that the children kind of gain out of this, right? Yeah. And is it that I want them to be, you know, obedient in that I want them to follow my word and not ask any questions and to just do as I say, you know, again, without any thought to like why I'm asking this?
Right.
Not necessarily. I don't want that. I don't want that for our society. I don't want that for my classroom. Right. I don't want that for our future. I want critical thinkers. I want people who ask questions. I want people, you know, again, one of my other favorite things into the classroom is sometimes, you know, as you're just an adult, you do get into that mindset of like, you have a schedule, you have things you have to get to do. You have to, you know, like, I have to go outside. We're out of ratio. I have to do this, right?
Yeah.
There's just things that just need to happen.
Safety things.
Safety things that just kind of need to happen. And so sometimes you just get into this, like, we have to go.
Yeah.
And, you know, children have no concept of time. So
that's right.
To them, they're just like, I want to do these things and I'm going this slowly. But again, one of my favorite things when I can, when I have those beautiful moments where, you know, a child is like, well, why are we doing this? Or I have this idea, or they're kind of pushing, you know, the boundary and kind of asking those types of questions, or, you know, like, well, I don't want to do this because of this reason. You know, it does make me sit and reflect and like, you know what? You're right. Maybe we don't have to do this right now. I think I was just in my adult brain on my own adult schedule. And now that you mention it, I don't think we have to do that right now. You're right.
You're right.
Obviously, there's times when, like, again, it's a safety thing. Like, we either need to do this or it's a ratio. Like, there's things that need to happen.
Sure.
But one of my favorite moments is when, you know, a child can remind me that we can do things differently. And I'm like, valid point. Okay.
Yeah. Well, you know,
and, let's read her right.
And, you know, in connection with social justice, I mean, to me, what you remind me of when you're saying that is I want critical thinkers, which means I want them, I need them to challenge and question my authority. I need them to do that. They shouldn't just automatically just say, because I said something. And I want them to know, like, from day one, the two-year-olds walk in the class, and I tell this story a lot, so people who've heard me talk before may have heard this before, but I always make sure that I have my box of plastic farm animals available when the two-year-olds arrive on the first day of class, and I pick up, I pick up the pig, and I say, the pig says moo. Right? Yep. And all of them laugh, right? Because they know that's not right. And they say, no, teacher Tom, the cow says moo. I mean, they tell me right away because I want them to listen to what I say. And if what I say doesn't match what they already know, I want them to know it's not just their right, but their responsibility. And I think that's really important. Yes. It's their responsibility as part of a member of this community to call me on it. And so, you know, one of the parents one time told me that he always saw his job with his kid is to really finely hone their BS detectors. And you know, that's a little cruder way of putting it. But to me, I think a lot of times we think as educators or as parents, even we think that, you know, oh God, you know, we don't want kids challenging our authority. You know, I'd say those naughty kids, rotten kids, they won't listen to me. And I just feel like that's not the kind of citizens we want, right? That's not the kind of people we want living in our communities. We need people who will stand up and say, that's not right. We don't want them to lose. We don't want to lose their curiosity. I think we also don't want them to lose their essential sense of fairness, right?
Yes.
Which for me is equity, equality, justice, all of these things that we talk about in early years. Always, every child wants to discuss fairness, and they know when things aren't fair. They know when it's. I mean, sometimes they're, you know, that's not fair because somebody's playing with something and they want it. So there's a little bit of teaching that goes in there, what fairness is. But that is really one of the most fundamental things they want to learn about, they're curious about, is fairness. Mm-hmm. And so when we can create an environment where fairness is just woven through everything we do, I mean, that's why, you know, I let the kids make their own rules. I mean, from day one, I don't make any rules. I mean, there are some rules that are safety-based that our insurance company requires, but I don't tell the kids those. I just figure my job is to, like, handle it, right? If there's a rusty nail sticking out, that's a hazard. I've got to get rid of the rusty nail. That's my job. Or broken glass on the playground. Urban playgrounds always have broken glass, so I have to make sure that's cleaned up. But when it comes to things like, you know, well, can we hit each other? Right? I don't make that rule, whether you can or cannot. Yeah. Now, I know that the safety rule might say they can't, but always, on that first day of class, 100% of the time, somebody comes to me and says, he hit me. And I, that's my chance to just say, you didn't, I can tell you didn't like that. Does anybody like to be hit? Nobody likes to be hit. Mm-hmm. Why don't we just all agree not to hit each other? And then, you know, I write down our list of agreements. Mm-hmm. They're not even rules. Write down and, you know, and then right on the spot. Their sense of fairness is like, well, and it's also a little bit of that, that golden rule thing too. You know, no kicking, mm-hmm. no biting, no taking.
If you're like me, you believe in the power of education and social justice. And what's more powerful than a good book? Today, I want to share an incredible way for you to support local independent bookstores while you indulge in your love of reading. Have you ever heard of bookshop.org? They're an amazing platform that connects readers just like us to independent booksellers all around the world. Local bookstores are essential for our communities. They foster culture, curiosity, and a lifelong love of reading. But they need our support to thrive, especially in this age of e-commerce giants. Bookshop.org is committed to helping those bookstores flourish. Every purchase you make on their site financially supports independent bookstores. That's right, every single purchase. They provide these stores with the tools they need to compete online and maintain their vibrant presence in our neighborhoods. They put their mission and public good above financial interests, giving over 80% of their profit margin to independent bookstores. That's a commitment you don't see every day. In fact, in 2020, they were recognized as the best of the world by B Labs, ranking in the top 5% of all B corporations. And guess what? It's written into their government's documents that they will never sell the company to Amazon or any major retailer. That's dedication to their mission. Plus, as a climate-neutral company, they're committed to operating sustainably. Another reason to feel good about your purchases. So if you're looking to buy a book and make a positive impact, head over to bookshop.org and use my affiliate link that's linked in my show notes below. By doing so, you'll be supporting local bookshops and helping them thrive. Let's make a difference one book at a time. Happy reading, and thank you for supporting our local bookshops.
Things from other people. They really put together their own list, and it's got all the stuff you would have put on there. Except now, instead of now me saying no hitting, when a child hits somebody else, I can say, oh, we all agreed not to hit each other. And that puts it back on them. That puts them back in that sense of that it's my job, my responsibility, my right and responsibility to be part of this community and to keep it going. And so I really, so people often say, you know, that this kind of sense of the liberation, you know, pedagogy and all that kind of stuff, it doesn't work in early years. I say they're wrong. I say this is the best place to be doing it.
Yes. And, you know, I'm always saying it doesn't mean that we're bringing in these really intense topics to young children. Yeah. So we're not, you know, you're not talking about school shootings to young children or anything like that, but you know, it's these kinds of topics, like about fairness, about community, about belonging, about who belongs in our community, about what we want to see in our community. Like those are ways that are, those are things that are already in restorative justice practices that we do, you know, for older levels. We can do the same things for younger levels, right? We might not be doing restorative circles in, you know, the same kind of structured way, but we might be taking those same tenets of, you know what does our community need and want, you know? And what do we want to see? Like, what behaviors do we want to see? And what behaviors, like, do we all agree we don't want to see? And I've done this with my classroom too. And it's really interesting to kind of see the different rules that they kind of come up with on the spot of, everyone should chew with their mouth shut. And they're all like,
they often are way more strict than we would be, right? With one another. They come up with every little nuance. It's like, you know, no throwing rocks at people, or no throwing wood at people, no throwing pine cones at people, no, you know, and they'll want to, they'll want to list every little thing, but that's okay. Because to me, that's part of that, that it's not formal, but it's part of that discussion, right? Well, let's clarify this. Let's be as clear as we can about what we want and don't want out of our community. And to me, that's, you know, that's the kind of citizen that democracies need, right? That's the way we should be looking at our world. It shouldn't be they and, you know, it should be us. And we are coming together with all our different wonderful perspectives. One of my favorite stories out of that, you know, you said, you know, you don't formally sit down and do this, but if you have a topic that is of value to the children, is that is important to them, they're going to sit down for 45 minutes or an hour and they're going to talk, talk it to death. Yep. I'd never forget. There was one time there was a group of boys, there was a few girls involved, but mostly it was boys, and they were playing. They were playing a game they called Bad Guys. No, wait, they were playing superheroes. That's what it was. They were playing superheroes, right? They were playing superheroes, and you know what that usually means is like standing boldly and flexing your muscles and bragging about mm-hmm. your powers, right? But one day, one of the mothers came to me and she said, my daughter, Hildy, told me she's scared of the superheroes. And she wants to make mm-hmm. a rule. See, think how empowered she felt. She wants to make a rule yeah. to ban superheroes. Now, I knew how that would go, right? Because we're not going to get consensus on that, but that's okay. So I said, okay. Mm-hmm. And this mother knew our way of doing things. So she said, I said, well, just you know, tell Hildy that when she feels like it, she can raise her hand at circle time and you know, suggest the rule and we'll have a discussion about it. And it took about mm-hmm. 3 days before she had the courage. She raised her hand and she said, I want to make a rule, no superheroes. And the room just fell silent. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly this group of boys that had been playing are right up next to me and they all just shout, no! And then what was interesting is that then there was another group of kids from the other part of the room that said, yes! And you could see Hildy mm-hmm. like look around like, she'd been worried that she was the only one. To hear that suddenly there were other people who had the same. And so, you know, there was a lot of yelling and, you know, up in arms. And I kind of calmed mm-hmm. everybody down. I said, let's just take turns. Hildy, why do you think we should have that rule? She said, well, they scare me. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget. And this is such a lesson in perspective. One of these boys up in the front, he just looked cross. He looked like he was about to cry. And he said, but we save people. And suddenly then the conversation became, and you know, we went around though and we let everybody talk about, you know, how they, you know, everybody got to share what they, and then one boy very cleverly said, what if you don't care? And we turned to, and so we said, okay, we decided we'd move all the superhero, pro superhero kids over to one side of the rug and the kids who mm-hmm. wanted to make the rule on the other side. And all the kids who didn't care got to sit in the middle, which was the majority. Right? Yeah. Which is kind of the way the world works. And it was such a great visualization for all of us to sit there looking at each other and seeing where we were. And then as we went through and each person shared why they like superheroes, why they don't like it, you would see mm-hmm. people start moving. They would start, you know, like the yeah. like they would say, well, you know, I kind of agree with that person. They would move to that agree. And then they would move back. And then by the end, we had a lot in the middle and we realized we couldn't make the rule ultimately. But mm-hmm. the conversation was enough. Right? The conversation yeah. suddenly changed everything. There was one of the boys was running, you know, boldly being a superhero a few days later, the cape behind him, you know, and he ran by this other boy a boy named Jack who just cringed. And, mm-hmm. and, but this time Owen stopped and he looked at Jack and he said, Jack, I'm sorry I scared you. and Jack goes, that's okay. It was just for a second. And suddenly then that just broke the barrier between them. They suddenly understood, at least they understood mm-hmm. there was another perspective out there that wasn't threatening to them.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's such a beautiful story for a lot of reasons. Cause it won it, you know, you could have just taken that parent's feedback and be like, okay, we're going to stop, you know, superhero play, you know, forever. And there wouldn't be discussion about it. And then for weeks on end, you would have had to be running around these, you know, particular kids being like, no superheroes. Right. Like, right. And then what's going to happen after, like all the early childhood right. educators know when you put the rule of like, no, don't do this. What are they going to do?
They're going to do it.
They're
going
to do it more.
One time when we were having, it was a different, similar kind of example. And they had been playing bad guys. That's why I said that at first it was bad guys. It's the same game, right? Still powers and yeah, posing fiercely. And mm-hmm. and so one girl complained about it. And his mother came to me like 3 or 4 days later. And she said, last night when we were saying our prayers at night, my son said to me, Henry said to me, he wasn't going to play bad guys anymore because what was his name? Charlize doesn't like it. Mm-hmm. And They switched to superheroes. It was the same game, but suddenly he had changed it, and it changed it for her as well. Mm-hmm. It's having the conversation, and this is what I think we forget yes. in our democratic society, is that you know mm-hmm. when we sit down together with other people, we're probably not going to change anybody's minds, right? Mm-hmm. It's hard to change yeah. people's minds. People, we have our beliefs for a reason, right? We know what we have. But what we can do is open up this concept of we can expand this concept of who we are, right? As a mm-hmm. community, as a society. And in preschool, we're talking communities. And for, you know, but I try to always think about community as just a smaller version of society, or should be.
Yep. Absolutely. It should just be like a smaller little society. And we see that in especially in early childhood, we see it when children are able to kind of express themselves freely and make their own rules and kind of engage in these types of dialogue. You see, like, you know, they start, you know, caring for each other in, you know, very special ways that they start showing these care for each other and being more observant. Whereas if I were the adult in the room who was constantly, you know, you can't hit so-and-so or go say sorry to so-and-so and just all these different, if I'm constantly the one who's moving the needle on that, you know, society in a community can't exist on just one person, right? It requires everyone to work together and everyone to see each other's humanity and everyone to value each other's input. And that's the beautiful thing within early childhood is that, you know, children can learn that there's different rules for different spaces, that roles can change, that, you know, roles can change, that they have the ability to kind of affect change within that classroom. That's one of my favorite things in, you know, the Reggio schools that I've worked at is usually that first day you walk into the classroom and it just kind of looks like a sad beige classroom. there's no art on the walls. Everything's just kind of like wood and bare. That you just have to remind parents, like, I swear it's going to look more like a classroom. Just give it time. Right. And as the school year goes on, you know, the children's artwork is on the walls and, you know, the tables are kind of spattered in paint that was supposed to be washable, but somehow stained the table.
It's never washable.
It's never washable. It never is. It says it right. Big bold letters, washable. And you're just like, well, why is it still here? Yeah. But, you know, you're seeing the classroom come to life because of the children's additions. You know, the classroom has shifted and changed because, you know, like, oh, the kids are, you know, taking the blocks from this area to another area. It seems like maybe they like to use these two things together. And just seeing how, you know, their actions affect change in that classroom and form that community. It's a powerful thing. And, you know, I've had classes that they still get together, like, you know, they're, you know, in elementary school, they're like third, fourth grade now, which is wild. But I've had these kinds of classrooms where they still meet up with each other. They still hang out with all the families are still friends. And that's a beautiful thing to know that in our, you know, our little classroom, we forged a community that forged these like lifelong connections that they take with them pretty much wherever they go. That's the power of this little communities that you can build.
it's so beautiful. And the other thing that I love about Reggio is that it was founded for the purpose of creating peace. It was a response to World War II, and it was all about educating for peace. And, you know, that's what we're talking about. That's why play-based learning is so important and powerful, because it honors each child's learning, each child's ability, and it also honors community.
Yes, absolutely. I love the ways that Reggio does honor community, that it honors people, that it honors, you know, democracy, and like you said, peace, and just the beautiful lessons that it has. And it's shifted and changed, you know, along the way. It shifts and changed from school to school based on, you know, the school's needs and the school's capacity, but I do love that it has those tenets, and everywhere I go, even, you know, I've worked outside of the classroom, I've worked, you know, in nonprofits, and just kind of worked in a number of different ways, but that's something that I always take with me is that, you know, those tenets, but most importantly, like the environment being your third teacher and really, really like, how is your environment hindering their learning, or how is your environment helping their learning, or how can I improve this environment? Like, it's an integral part of our learning. It's just the way that our environment is set up. Like, did I actually set this up to be successful?
Right. Or, you know, I mean, it's so sometimes it's as simple as, you know, did I build a racetrack in my classroom? And that's why they're running around. And some, you know, I'll never forget moving. We had we had this small classroom, and our outdoor space was this small little courtyard with a high stone concrete kind of wall. It was very echoey. We were always trying to, you know, figure out ways to make it less echoey, but that's okay. But you know, the good part as an educator is you're out there, you're hearing everything. You know what's going on in any corner of the room. You don't even have to look. You can just hear. And then we moved to a place with a giant playground, big outdoor space with lots of, you know, natural stuff. And I remember thinking, my new teacher needs me to be a new teacher, right? My third teacher, suddenly now it's like stuff could be going on that I couldn't hear And so I had to focus more on my visual senses than my, you know, I'd been relying so much on my ears to kind of keep track of what was going on. And now suddenly I had to shift the way I positioned my body because she was requiring that of me. Mm-hmm. I always refer to my third teacher and with the female pronouns. Like maybe I shouldn't, but I've always thought of her that way.
I love it. And yeah, just that third teacher, it's important. And, you know, it will tell you things if you listen.
Yeah. Oh yeah. When it tells kids things all the time, listening. Right? You have a long, narrow hallway. What does that say? It says run.
Oh yeah. 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 I remember like one of my first classrooms that me and my co-teacher had designed, and we had this beautiful design and everything was so great. And very quickly we learned that there was this very small, narrow kind of strip in between where the kids could just run.
Yeah.
And they were just booking it, just back and forth, like, yeah, we're running. And, you know, being the teachers we are, we're like, oh, okay, I see you have excited bodies. Maybe let's redirect this energy, right? But eventually we kind of found ways to stop the corridor of running. Yeah.
Well, what I did was, you know, we had this long hallway that was between our classroom and getting outside, right? And it was an unfortunate part of our layout, right? It was part of our third teacher that was a challenge, is I couldn't just have indoor-outdoor be a natural flow because it was too far away. Mm-hmm. So we had to go out from the classroom out to the outdoors. And and the first day I said, okay, let's go outside. They just killed each other, right? They just all tried to get through that door at the same time and they were trampling and falling and crying. And so what I realized, I thought, okay, how am I going to do this? You know, and one way would be to block things and to organize things. What I did was I just started letting them go one at a time and they got to run. That was it. We weren't going to tell them not to run. It was like, just like, okay. Yeah. Okay. And I tried to, you know, Sophia's turn and she would just book it down the hall to get down there. Yeah. It's Micah's turn and he'd go booking down the hall because, you know, we have to learn to work with those teachers, right? They have their limitations just like we do. And I love the, you know, the way I'm so happy that the theory of loose parts has become as popular as it has, because that is a theory about environment, right? That is a theory that comes out of architecture, actually, which is so fascinating to me. Simon Nicholson was a landscape architect. In 1977 or so, he wrote an article called The Theory of Loose Parts, How Not to Cheat Children. And it was so profound. It's actually a really radical concept about how architecture, his basic idea was that, you know, in architecture, but in all of the arts, we turn over the fun part to the experts, right? He called them the chosen few or something like that. The chosen few got to design the building and the rest of us just went to the building and appreciated it. And he said, you know, what if we create places where everything's movable, where everybody who comes to this space in a lot, whether it's a library or a school or a museum, and each person gets to have the fun of rearranging the space and organizing it. And, you know, and that becomes, when you think about it, an incredibly profound democratic idea, right? We should all walk into those spaces and be able to create them the way we want. That's why loose parts are without scripts built into them, right? Because so many of the toys, like if you give a child a Lego set that you can build into a Death Star, there's only one thing you can do with that toy, right? I mean, we all know there are other things you can do, but most kids, most of the time, find a parent to help them build the Death Star and it sits on their dresser for, you know, until they go off to college. Even then, I know some kids who've taken their Death Stars with them to college. I know, but it's, you know, Legos, the whole idea of Legos was that you could build anything you wanted with these little plastic blocks. And so I used to take, you know, so anyway, but to take the scripts out of it and to suddenly, you know, if a child's out there and there's a pine cone and a piece of wood and a broken car with no wheels on it, what are they going to, there are so, I watch children play with these things all the time. And I would go through these little phases once in a while where I'd say, the playground's getting kind of junky. There's a lot of broken stuff out here. And I'd start saying to the kids, okay, should I throw this away? No, we're still using that. And then I would say, really? I haven't seen you play with it. They would immediately take it and they'd spend the rest of the day playing with it, right? Figuring out a way to look, I build a bad guy trap, or I build a castle for my,
It's astounding just the things that kids do. I remember when I was a kid, Like I said, I've been doing the artist way for the last couple of weeks, and it's been helping me reconnect with my inner artist and my inner child. Nice. But one of my favorite toys growing up, it wasn't even like a Barbie or anything. It was just a hair tie that mm-hmm. I had like fashioned into like this little weird thing. And I put like a little Barbie dress on it, and it was my favorite toy. And if my mom tried to throw it away, I would have just had a complete meltdown. Like, no, that is my favorite thing. And it was the most, I had toys, but that, right. I think cause I made it, I think that's why it was special to me.
Yeah, sure.
No, I made it. Yeah. I made a toy. This is my thing. Uh-huh. But yeah, just the smallest things that all the random things that kids attach to is always just hilarious. Yeah. And I love it.
Yeah, we had
like
this,
what suddenly becomes their favorite thing.
I used to tell the parents in our school, cause we were a cooperative, and I would say to the parents, I'd say, if you have something you're going to throw out, think about the preschool first before you throw it out, you know, yeah. something from your garage or attic or basement. Mm-hmm. And there was one of the moms, when she was young, she had been a swimmer and water polo enthusiast and had all these trophies. And she was getting to get rid of them. They were junky, cheap little trophies. And she just brought this huge box full of trophies, you know, and the kids, they had a blast with them, right? They could do all kinds of yeah. things with them. But eventually they get broken and the pieces, you know, get thrown away and stuff like mm-hmm. that. And so there were just bits and pieces. Every once in a while, they would find like the water polo player, you know, poised to throw the ball or something mm-hmm. like that. And one day a boy was, we had it. And I was like, I don't remember what we were doing with it. And the boy said, can I have that? Because we were calling it a baby. That's right. We were pretending like it was a baby. Everybody was saying, oh, this is the baby. This is the baby. And he said, can I have the baby? And so I handed it to him. And he said, I'm going to go drown the baby. And you're as an adult, you kind of go, now what's going on here? And mm-hmm. he went over. And so he said, Teacher Tom, I can't drown the baby. He came back. I can't drown it. And I was like, okay, you know, I went over, I had to see what was going on. I walked over there and I saw this little plastic figurine floating in a bucket of water. And he said, I can't drown it. He kept trying to push it under the water, kept floating back up. So it was just so amazing to watch this. What he was doing was, you know, he meant mm-hmm. like, I wanted to sink the baby. And he was discovering that plastic mm-hmm. floats, right? So he was coming up, yeah. but he was learning vocabulary in context, mm. right? He was learning vocabulary. Yeah. He was learning physics and water displacement and all of these kinds of amazing things mm-hmm. just from a broken trophy and a bucket of water.
Wow. That is, I love those kinds of moments in the classroom. Yeah. Like when you just get to explore something, you're like, what do you mean by this? My favorite yeah. question is like, tell me about your idea.
Right.
Like you'll just see like kids stacking milk crates on top of each other. I'm like, I need to know what your idea is really.
Right.
What are we planning? Is this a safe choice we're making? But I have one more question for you.
Uh-huh.
And that is, how do you reimagine education?
Well, I mentioned to you before we started, I'm reading a book called The Extended Mind right now. A big part of the book is about how much better the scientists who study this, 100% of human beings who've been tested on this, their brains work better when they're outdoors. 100%. They can't find anybody whose brains are not more sharp and by any measure that they're trying to use to measure this. So obviously, that tells me that if our schools, if education was going to follow the science, a lot more outdoor time would be there. Mm-hmm. And in fact, right now, and this conversation is helping motivate me, I've written two books. I'm just begun work on my third book, and it's going to address exactly that issue. What if we followed all of the science about how learning works and how brains function, how bodies and brains work together, how human minds work with their environments, with other people, and all of this kind of stuff? I think if I were going to, right off the top of my head, give you a nutshell version of what I would do with schools, I would probably fire all the teachers. I'd keep the cafeteria people. I'd keep the gardeners. I'd keep the maintenance people. I would hire the rooms out for professional artists and carpenters and auto mechanics. And I would create these community centers where kids from the ages, and this is radical, right? From birth through 18 years old, they get to come to this place. And all of these people, the cafeteria people, if an 18-year-old comes in and wants to participate, they get them involved with cooking and chopping and all this. When the 2-year-old comes in, they find a way for the 2-year-old to be part of this community. the garden would be growing the food that they're going to be eating. They would be, you know, they'd be putting on plays and there'd be musicians. It would be a place for senior citizens to come hang out. Now this is, you know, Nirvana, right? The senior citizens would be there to be audiences for the kids, to teach them from their own wealth of knowledge. I imagine, you know, I said auto mechanics. I mean, my idea would be if your car's, you know, if there's something wrong with your car, you bring it into the school and there's a professional mechanic and your own kid might work on the car, right? If that's what their interest is, if they're going to go, I'm going to go, you know, or just wash the car and create this kind of sense of community. My idea would be that at the end of the day, parents don't just come and pick up their kids. Is they actually come in, they eat their dinner there within their community. They have their cars fixed. They watch their kids' musical performances. Maybe they participate with their kids. And that's what you do in the evenings rather than watching TV or going shopping or something like that, is that we create these communities of people who live near each other coming together, you know, in an open, and, you know, there's all kinds of, I can think of all kinds of naysayers to that. But that is sort of the vision that I think of, because it's that sense of community, multi-age, lots of outdoor space, because we already have the physical buildings, but we have these huge grounds at a lot of schools where you could spread out and do all kinds of amazing things. You know, I think a lot about the Sudbury model. I'm sure you're familiar with the Sudbury or the Democratic Free School model. You know, that's what we do in play-based learning, is really Sudbury in a lot of ways, and Reggio. And I feel like, instead of talking about them as schools, we talk about as community centers, as places for community to come together, create community. And we're going to learn most of what we need to learn that way.
I adore that. I think I love asking that question, because it's important that we keep dreaming big, that we keep thinking about these types of things and really imagining what the future of education looks like. And I think, you know, it's important that we don't get complacent. We don't get in that mindset of, well, this is the way it's always been, and I guess this is the way we're going to keep going. Like, no, that's the beauty in education, that things can change. We're constantly learning about best practices. We're learning about how children learn. We're learning about, you know, more science is coming out that shows us more about how children are learning and what's going on. And so, like, we can start listening to that, and we can start imagining, what does that look like? Does it look like we're forging these communities? And, you know, I could think about some of my best, you know, school experiences, the things that really stood out. It wasn't when I was sitting down, you know, being bestowed upon knowledge from the adult in the room. It was when my hands were doing the thing, right? When I was, I had, you know, say in what I was learning, and it was exciting to me. And those are the moments that really, really stand out, and they really stick out. And they were fun. You know, I had a good time learning.
Yeah. Well, I call those moments the moments that you've come alive. And I feel like we live in a world where a lot of people never come alive. And for me, that to me, the purpose of education, however you want to structure it right now, the purpose, if you ask elected officials or you ask policymakers, they're almost, or even most parents, they're going to say, well, you know, to get a job. And, you know, if all it is vocational training, then let's let the corporations train their own workers. Why are we doing it in a democratic society? Why are we all paying for it and doing it as a community? No, we do it because we want good citizens. And the best citizens are those who have found their purpose in life. And if what we consider education, that, especially that, you know, that birth through, you know, 18 years old time frame, as a chance for children to learn what it means to be up, feel like you're alive, and just for, even for a day, even for a week, but maybe they find the thing that brings them alive for a lifetime. But what they'll learn is the habit of pursuing, finding a purpose in life, being self-motivated, and also knowing that everybody else around them is self-motivated too. And just imagine the world we could create if all those purposeful people, those people coming alive, are bouncing off of each other.
Yes, coming alive, bouncing. I love it. I love that. I want to see that. I want more kids to experience that and to be a part of it, and to just know what it feels like to just have something that you're passionate about. Like, you know, when you're working with a kid and you see that they're doing something that they love, and of course that might change over time.
But of course,
like, you see them coming alive when they're talking about their special interests, whether it's, you know, garbage trucks or the trash truck or or the dinosaurs or anything like that. Like when they're talking about the thing that they love more than anything else, you could see it in their eyes. You could see it in they're just talking to you at like 1,000 miles a minute, and they can't stop talking about it. And they can't stop learning about it, and they want all their friends to see it.
Exactly. They motivate their friends to take an interest in it.
They motivate their friends. And one kid who loved bugs, and so he was learning all about like ladybugs. He's like, ladybugs eat aphids, and now I know that ladybugs eat aphids.
Right. Oh, I say that all the time. He just like everything I know about dinosaurs, I've learned in conversations with preschoolers. Everything I know. I personally have no interest, but now, like, you know, and to hear, you know, when you're listening to 3-year-olds using words like Jurassic and carnivore and herbaceous, and you know. Mm-hmm. And all these, and they're talking about concepts like extinction and evolution. Yeah. And you're going, you know, nobody would put that in a 3-year-old's curriculum because they get to make their own curriculum. And it's always age appropriate. And it's always perfect when they make it for themselves.
Always, always, always. I love that. That's a perfect thing to end on. On that note, where could my audience find you?
I have the blog, which is called Teacher Tom's Blog, which, you know, that's, I've been writing there since 2009, and that's where you found me, Brittany, that blog spot, the simple one. Mm-hmm. TeacherTom'sWorld.com, the Teacher Tom's World, possessive with the S in there, TeacherTom'sWorld.com is where you'll find out about where my podcast is. You can get links to my books. You get links to all the other stuff I'm doing, my courses. But really what I'd like to do is just come to my website, and on the first page, a little pop-up window will come up at the bottom there. And I've got a free, you know, Teacher Tom's top 10 posts on play-based learning. Cause I realized that I have, you know, I've been writing for so long, I probably have 4,500 posts on there, and it's impossible for anybody to find stuff they're looking for. So I tried to curate just like a download, for people who want to come and just, you know, and get inspired. Or to just, if you're somebody who doesn't know anything, it gets you kind of some, you know, some ground floor kind of stuff. But if you're somebody who's, you know, like you, Brittany, or anybody else who's like really experienced, I hope it'll inspire you, because we need to constantly be getting inspired. And teaching can be exhausting, right? As we've talked about. And we all need we love our work, but it is the most tiring job in the world. Because we can't take a day off. You can't even take a minute off because you're responsible for these young people and you want to be present for them. And at the end of every day, you know, we're tired and sometimes we need a little inspiration. So that's kind of my idea behind it. So, you know, they can come to teachertomsworld.com and download that for free and just get a little inspiration.
I love that. And you were inspiration to me when I first started teaching, and you continued to be an inspiration. You know, looking through the blog, it just, you know, reading the last couple of posts, I was like, wow, this is amazing. This is still the same amazing, great quality that it was several years ago.
Well, I love to keep on with
the inspiration.
We talked earlier about the journeys, right? And I think a lot of people would have deleted their first couple of years of posts by now. Because when I go back and read the ones from 2009, 2010, there's a lot of them that embarrass me. Then I just think, oh my God, I've grown so much. But I want to leave them there because I want to show that there is, it's all a journey. And, you know, I didn't want to, you know, anything I said, if anybody felt like, oh, you know, Tom was judging me or something like that, I'm not judging you. We're all at a different place in our journey. We're all just trying our best as parents, as teachers, just as human beings in the world. We're all just doing the best we can every day. And they might not be doing as good as you want them to do, but that's not your business, right? Everybody's doing the best they can.
Yep. Everyone's doing the best they can. And I always say it, I'm super grateful that MySpace has kind of just exploded. Because back in the day, MySpace was where all of my teenage thoughts just went. Uh-huh. So I'm glad that that's been eliminated from the internet. So. I got a nice fresh start. So I definitely understand, because if that was just existing on the internet, I'm like, ooh.
Yeah.
Well, those were inside thoughts, friend.
Right. We did. Well, you know, and you grew up in the part where you were like right on the front lines, right? I remember, you know, I remember when my daughter was young, she's 27 now. So I don't know what old you are. I don't care. But she was, you know, she's 27, but I remember when she was young, and I would be like, you know, you got to be careful because it's a public place. And it, a lot of people mm-hmm. a little bit older than her didn't know that. And she said, oh, I've seen what they do. I know that it's a public mm-hmm. place. And it's so delightful to watch people her age right now, at least her friends, on social media, they are so kind to one another. And that's not what's supposed mm-hmm. to be happening. But I listened the way through high school and stuff, I was realizing they understand this is for posterity. Right? Yes. These are the stories that people are going to tell about them. They can take save your private thoughts for the journal you're sticking under your mattress. Right?
Yeah.
If you're going to think something scary, you know, do that. Anyway, you can cut all that part out of the podcast.
I think it was beautiful, but thank you so much. I feel like I could talk to you for hours, but I should probably let you go at some point.
I could talk to you for hours too, but you know, probably something I should be doing.
Probably. I want to thank you so much. I know my friend Amanda, a shout out to Amanda. She was very excited that I was going to talk to you today. So hi, Amanda. Here's a shout out for you. And thank you so much for joining me. I hope you have a wonderful, wonderful rest of your day.
You too, Brittany. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye. Thank you so much for tuning into Conscious Pathways. Don't forget to like, share, and subscribe to Conscious Pathways wherever you get your podcasts. And please don't forget to leave a rating or review. It really does help the podcast to grow and reach more listeners just like you. And until next time, don't forget to navigate your conscious journey with courage and kindness. And I'll see you there for more transformative conversations and education. Bye!